You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Mark Zhao Sanders, who is the co-founder and CEO of Filtered.com, a learning tech company that focuses on developing business skills within the workplace and using data to identify, analyze, and deliver the most important skills to organizations. He regularly writes about topics including algorithms, learning, and productivity in places like the Harvard Business Review and Scientific American and the MIT Sloan Management Review. He's got a new book. It's called Time Boxing, The Power of Doing One Thing at a Time. So note, pretty impressed by this book. It's a methodology that I think works. And I did promise Mark that I'm going to try it for a week. And so likely there is an addendum at the end to this podcast that records how that went. But I think you'll enjoy the podcast in any regard. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Mark Zhao Sanders, welcome to the podcast.
Kelly, very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So one of the things I do when I'm prepping for a podcast with a new guest is that I Google for video of them to make sure I'm pronouncing their name correctly. This only sometimes works because many people I found don't want to correct the host when they mispronounce their name. That's a complete aside. But when I Googled you, I was surprised at how many interviewers framed the methodology of your book, Time Boxing, as multitasking. To be clear, the subtitle of your book is The Power of Doing One Thing at a Time, which I would suggest is the opposite of multitasking. And I'm kind of firmly on the record, and I think science backs me up, that multitasking, as we know in contemporary knowledge work, is actually not a thing. It inherently means you're doing multiple things less well. So let's start this conversation by clearing up multitasking as compared to time boxing. Are they connected? Are they not?
I mean, you're definitely right that, okay. That's a mischaracterization, you know, for anyone that associates time boxing with multitasking. I mean, the definition of time boxing that I use, there are four components to it: what, when, one, enough. So what is the, you know, deciding what's most important for you to do, that day? When is obviously when you're going to do it and putting it into a properly digital calendar. The one is, you know, this is what you're referring to. So, you know, doing one thing at a time, single tasking, and not multitasking. There are some exceptions to that, by the way, which I maybe will come back to in a second. And then the last bit is enough, you know, doing it to an acceptable standard, not chasing perfection so that you get something which is, you know, useful to the world done in that time. So yeah, I mean, one element of the philosophy, of the method, of the system of time boxing is exactly that. It's single tasking. The exception, I think, is that there are certain combinations of tasks. If you're really familiar with one of them, you can do a second task and it's not a problem. So, you know, I'm not absolutely dogmatic about it. It needs to be one task, but you know, if you're cooking, a dish that's familiar to you and you want to listen to a podcast, that's absolutely fine. You know, knock yourself out. The idea really is if it's a cognitively difficult task or it's a brand new task, then it's probably best for you to do just that one thing, and time boxing is in favor of that.
The thing I like about your framing around all this, you write in the book, quote, "We fail to make space for the habits and activities that will lead us to that which we long for, truly long for: self-development, a successful career, fulfilling relationships, good health, a happy, intentional life." This is not just about work. This is about how we exist in the modern world as we know it. Work is a big part of that for many people, but it's about time. And where, and this is such an improv thing, right? You know, in improvisation, you have to be fiercely in the moment when you're doing the work because there is no script. And I would suggest life is the same way. And I think that's how you're perceiving it as well.
I mean, it's definitely not just just a work thing. It applies certainly at work, and you know, we will have a lot of meetings that we need to get through with work. Those tend to go into a time boxed into a calendar, and they look a lot like time boxes. So one of the things I say is that look, really, this is just an extension of something that we're doing already, probably at work, which is to, you know, carve out some time in our calendar and make some commitment. But we just do it a little bit more with time boxing. So first of all, there's that to say. But then if you think about the rest of your time, I mean, you know, for most people, they're not working most of the time. So they have, you know, their leisure time. You could split the 24 hours into three chunks, right? So work, call that 8 hours. Of course, it's not going to be exactly eight for most people most of the time, but roughly 8 hours, 8 hours of being awake, but doing something else, so let's call that leisure, and then you got 8 hours of sleep. So it's not precise, but it's a useful heuristic for thinking about this. Well, let's be intentional about all of that time, and even sleep. You know, let's make sure that we set ourselves up to sleep well in order that for our 16 hours or so of a waking life, we get the most out of it and feel the best that we can. But certainly for the 8 hours of leisure as well, just like the 8 hours of work, be intentional about it. And being intentional, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche. What do we really mean? I would say that if you sit down in a quiet moment and think about what's most important to you, what is a good use of time, we all have a pretty good sense of what that is. So that might be meditating, it might be reading, it might be exercise, learning and self-development, it might be spending time with friends, family, it might be something else, right? You know, a particular hobby that you have. But what happens is that we don't find time, or as much time as we should, for those things, because it gets crowded out by the pushes and pulls of other people on our time. And very often, actually, that device in our pocket, you know, the smartphone with, you know, social media apps that are on it. I mean, it's a cliche to say, but of course that is a real time sink. So my contention is that we know very well how we should spend our time. If we make a commitment to do that in the moments of calm and of quiet, where we're thinking clearly, then we see that through, and time boxing is a system for doing that, we'll live a more intentional life in a really pragmatic, real sense.
So this is the thing that was very simple and very radical inside this concept. So I have a to-do list that I keep. And of course, good. I have a digital calendar where I put my schedule. And
it's a great start.
Well, that's most simple. You're saying put those things together for your day. And take 30 minutes, 15 minutes before you start your work day to set that out. This seems so smart in the same sense of the minute when I dedicate myself to exercise every morning. The way I do it is I set my alarm, well, the evening before, I lay out my workout clothes on the steps that lead up to my fourth floor where I have my little workout area, and I set my alarm at 5 o'clock. And I know I have my little rituals, go downstairs, feed the dog, let him out, make my coffee, have a little coffee, check my email, whatever I do, and then go upstairs and do my workout. It's like that is the way I do that. If I didn't set that up, it would not happen because I'm a human being and I am going to be drawn, you know, elsewhere. This, if you set it up in your calendar, it's like it would be hard not to be intentional with your full day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you've got it. That's absolutely spot on. I mean, with your example of the exercise, I think, you know, the evening before, when things are calm and quiet and you probably don't have so many pulls on your time, that's when you're thinking clearly. And it's exactly that. You're going to have a good intention, which is to do some exercise. And because you're making that commitment, you're signaling to yourself that that's what I'm going to do. Right? I'm going to lay out some, you know, my sneakers, as you call it over there, trainers, as we call it over here. And then, you know, whatever the outfit is and, you know, a towel. Then of course, when it came to it the next morning, you could still refuse. right? You could say, well, I said I was going to do this last night, but I'm not going to. But in reality, we almost always do. In fact, there's science that backs this up, that, you know, implementing our intentions, once we're serious about the intention, it's something like 90% of the time we'll do it. Of course, it's not 100, but it's 90. And it's a lot higher than if you didn't, you know, make that commitment than the evening before. And then what you're saying, yeah, of course, does this extend from exercise to really any other? This is a big point that I make with the, you know, in the book, that it's, time boxing is pretty special because it's a meta habit. If you can nail time boxing, think about all the slots in your calendar over the course of a week. You can fill it with whatever is, you know, makes sense for you and your life. I mean, some of the examples I gave earlier, meditation, reading, exercise, learning and what have you. You can do, because you can live exactly the life that your better self knows that you should live. And in most cases, you will see it through 90% of the time, or maybe more. In my case, it's a bit more than that because I'm pretty sort of, you know, rigid about it. And I also have written a book on time boxing, so I kind of need to be doing it. And I've been doing it for, you know, for over 10 years. But yeah, you know, for anyone, it'll be more than 90% of the time you're actually ending up spending time on what you what you should be, or what matters to, you know, really matters to you, rather than, you know, just being pulled in the direction of the latest notification on WhatsApp or, you know, or Instagram. So yeah, exactly. It's a meta habit one. I mean, I say, what do I say? It's, you know, the one, habit to rule them all, because if you get this one, you get so many others for free. It's a bit like James Clear's, habit stacking. BJ Fogg talks about this as well, but just really tangibly. So what's that, the one habit to stack them all on? It's your weekly. I mean, I use the weekly view most of all, but it's your schedule for the week. If you can really get to that, and you're already doing it anyway, because like you said, you've already got a to-do list. You've already got a digital calendar. So you're already doing it. So you're a long way along the line to have mastering this meta habit and living a more intentional life, Kelly. You're very close.
We had BJ on the pod, and Cal Newport's a friend. He was just on the podcast for the second time a couple weeks ago. And awesome. one of the things I love about his work that connects with yours is this idea of, if you could, the calendar displays where you're at, and when people pull on your time, this great idea of sending them your calendar if they want to set a meeting and sort of say, hey, here's my schedule. You know, where do you see this fitting in? And what time would you need of me? And I talked about this with one of my bosses here, because I said, if we all did this and our calendars are looking that full, well, that says something to us, because we're in a creative job here, and almost all of us have to have time to think and to play. That's at the heart of improvisation, the thing we teach, the thing we... And for me, it's funny, I use color a little bit in my calendar, and I use red for my speaking dates, because of what I want to signal is those are things that I really can't move, because I've made a commitment, someone has paid whatever good money for this. And anything that's not in red is... could be up for grabs at a certain point. So I get from you too that rather than allow the fullness of the calendar to intimidate you, that in fact the fullness of that would be the beginning to set you free. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, right? I think that. So when some people see my calendar and it's all time boxed up, they say, you know, this looks like a nightmare. So restrictive. Yeah. How can you live your life like that, Mark? But to me, I mean, if you think it through logically, each one of those time boxes is me saying, this is an important thing for me to do. This is the thing I want to do that's important for me to do. And then seeing it through. So I think it's a visualization of the freedom that I'm living, of my system for making sure that I'm doing the things that I, you know, I really want to do. Color coding is interesting, and that sort of collaborative component, that's, you know, that's really good. I think that if you're signaling to your colleagues, you're preempting the question. So you put it in a shared calendar and you're saying, okay, look at these slots in the week. It's red. It's really important that I do these things, and they're just kind of immovable, you know, barring emergency or whatever. And that's clear in terms of your ways of working with your colleagues. This could apply to, you know, family and friends as well, by the way, but, you know, in your context, your colleagues, then at the very least, it's just efficient communication. you know, beyond your own sort of personal productivity and intention and all of that. So yeah, I think collaborating more harmoniously and with greater efficiency is one of the many benefits that you get from time boxing and putting it into a shared calendar that others can see as well. It also signals transparency and your confidence that, look, this is how I'm spending my time. Maybe some of the appointments I'm going to make private because they, you know, they just are private. But in general, I'm happy for people to take a look at what's going on in order to make a judgment as to, you know, whether to rope me into this meeting or bring me into this piece of work. I think it's a modern way of going about things.
It is funny that I've heard this argument, right? That, like, you know, where's the privacy in terms of, you know, your privacy in terms of sharing your calendar? And it's just so rich, given the person who's saying that has explained to me where they were every minute of the day on social media. So it's like, it's I thought we gave that up a while ago. And also, given where we have come from and evolved as a species, where everyone was in everyone's business, that was a matter of survival at a certain point. And we want to be accepted, and we want to be socialized, and we want to be loved. We need to. It's at our basis of being human. So we let these things fight each other, when in fact there potentially is great harmony if we sort of let go.
We really are so inconsistent how we think about the importance of our personal data in different contexts. You know, we'll fight so hard to defend it in a certain area, and yet just give it all away for free on certain social media outlets. So yeah, I think that's it doesn't really stack up, that objection to putting that into your, you know, putting some of this information into a shared calendar with a few people that you work with at work, when you can also make some of it private anyway. So I hear a few objections to time boxing. Obviously, you know, you write a book on it and then you hear a few things back. That's one of them that comes up a couple of times, but it's not one that I'm particularly fearful of when I hear it.
Do you time box your weekend?
Yeah.
So how's that
a little
different?
Bit less. Yeah, a little bit less intensively, and you'll look at, so the colors that I generally have on my time box calendar, there are four colors. So I have some regular work, which is blue, then I have high value work, which is green. So obviously between the two, I'm CEO of a tech company. I should be trying to shift, you know, from blue to green, but inevitably there is some blue. Then yellow is leisure time with, you know, family, friends, and also just myself. And then finally, purple is a book related activity. Wow. So those are the four that I have. And so in general, at the weekend, there will be a bit more purple, which is book activity, and of course, yellow. But the reason I put the items in is, I mean, once I suppose that they happen, and I'm talking about, you know, this is dedicated one-to-one time with one of the kids or both of the kids, for example, so that it actually happens, or spending some time with a neighbor, or, you know, calling my mom, or just, you know, things that you would probably do, but it just makes sure that it happens. And not only, so that's like a forward looking, make sure that it happens in the future, but it also means that you've got a record of it. You can look back and, you know, how did I celebrate my son's 10th birthday? Sure, there'll be some photos, but you've also then got this, really nice, naturally forming, you know, organic record of all the things that were important enough for you to put into your calendar. So yeah, I do the weekends and evenings too. I wouldn't say I time box it. I mean, literally 24 hours of my life. It's something like, on average, I don't know, 12, 15 hours a day, that is time boxed to some extent. Yeah.
I think that point about the past is important, because there are so many times where I'm like, how did we get here? Both with a success or a failure, you know, and sometimes in between. And it's like, if I had that record of like, oh, it was during this time and these things were going on, you can maybe understand in a bit richer of a way, because the cognitive load that we're dealing with, and this is also why you're doing this, right? It is shocking to me how little science has been done about the modern workplace and the various ways we are forced to communicate. So we're talking phone, text, in-person, Teams, WhatsApp, Slack. And then you've got LinkedIn. You have whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever. There are easily 12 different things that we're supposed to balance and understand and it's impossible. And future generations are going to look back at this, right, and be like, who thought email was a good idea, you know, at a certain point. And so what time boxing at least does is it at least gives you some agency over your own hours in a day, which is something that is being hijacked from all of us throughout our days and evenings.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you have made that association between agency and time boxing. I was at a festival last summer and I was, you know, having a good time. I was dancing. I'd written the book at this point, and it came to me as this moment of clarity that really the book is at bottom about agency. And I think that really is that really is the case. On a couple of points that you raised there about the past. So, you know, of course, we're processing so much information. It's really intense. Very often, if someone asks me at the end of the day, oh, so what did you get up to today? No idea. I cannot think, you know, they're live in the moment. Now, of course, because I've time boxed it all, I can, you know, review it. And actually, that's a very nice exercise that I run with myself at the end of the week. It's a personal reflection, just looking at the time boxed calendar that I have. And, you know, it sparks all these memories of, well, yeah, and you were great in this meeting and you need to follow up there. And wasn't this a good a way of spending a time with, you know, one-to-one with this person? It's a very nice way of just not just reflecting. It's giving you a tool to reflect, but in a little bit more detail. And the other thing that you said that I thought was interesting there is that about the past is, you know, it's hard to know why we do certain things at certain times. And you're never going to get a full answer to that. You know, we're always on a journey to understand ourselves better. But by having some of this contextual information about how your time was spent, it can, you know, post-event help you rationalize and understand where, you know, what the stresses and strains or the joys that you were going through at a certain time. So it is a little bit about understanding yourself better. And just, you know, more concretely, I think I get to do that on a weekly basis at the end of a Friday when I'll just spend, just 15 minutes, but just, you know, looking over what has happened. And I do feel like I get to know myself, better, and it is sort of therapeutic.
Working in improvisation and comedy, we are all deeply nerdy about timing and time. Second City is short form content, so it's a series of these short long pieces, they're structured in a very certain way, and the running order of material is important, and that comes from vaudeville and all this stuff. But one of the phrases in improvisation, you know, when you are making something out of nothing, is start in the middle. And this idea is like too much exposition up top, you're going to lose the audience. If you can get to, it's sunny here in Acapulco, why did you leave me? You know, you have already set up everything that you can sort of jump into. And you talk, and I think this is the opposite of this, of bewaring the long middle, which is the mire, right? That happens sometimes if you're, you know, getting started on something and then you just sort of get anchored in this quagmire. Is that what you mean by that?
Well, okay, so I don't want to go up against improv, especially not with you, Kelly. I'd actually say that. So what I'm talking about with the long middle is not to set a time box, which is, you know, 2 hours long or, you know, 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And then of course the start is clear and the end is clear, but you know, in the middle, you can just get a bit lost and time is wasted. It can feel, frustrating. When you say about, let's just start in the middle with improv and let's just get going, right? So there is a key there, you know, and you can kind of set the situation up with a sentence, and then, you know, immediately the juices are flowing of, you know, whoever's involved. I think that's great, and actually that relates very much to what I'm saying with at the start of a time box, or just getting something going. Start with something very small that's going to start to get the juices flowing. Yeah. Now that might be literally as simple as just pick up your pen or your pencil and break that initial procrastination, or it might be to write down a few bullet points that are, you know, to do with the issues of this particular, you know, work task or work situation that you've got, putting it into, you know, a Google Doc or, you know, a Word Doc. So it might be very, very small, but it's just getting the juices flowing. Actually, a lot like what you're doing with
yeah.
that. I mean, you call it starting in the middle. But it's starting, isn't it? So, I mean, really, it's I think they're actually saying the same thing. It's starting. Yeah.
But also the other thing that an improviser has done is there is prep work, and that prep work is often like walking the stage with the ensemble. We do a thing here at Second City before we go on stage is every ensemble member pats each other on the back and says, I've got your back. And these are all rituals. This is all prep for the creative work, which is different because there is no script often when you're coming out. You're getting to, at Second City, we create scripts through improvisation, but it's all part of a process. But that prep work is absolutely essential. It's why there's a call time that's a half hour before you go on stage. It's this recognition. And again, the other thing is that a typical improv class is 3 hours. What we know is you cannot do more work, this kind of work, outside of that. And there are breaks built in that time. It's a very intentional piece of time. And, you know, one of the things I love about your, I think your calendar, you say, is 15, is it 15, 30, 60, or is it?
Yeah, exactly. You got it right. Yeah, you read attentively. My time boxes are 15, 30 or 60 minutes. So I don't need to make too many decisions about how long they're going to be, and they're relatively short. So Cal, who a friend of yours and you've had on the show, a big part of that for me is a big part of time boxing is getting to deep work, just pragmatically. Okay. How am I going to scale those heights and get into that, flow state? And it's by setting a time box of appropriate length and really getting into it. Just when you were riffing there on improv, and I love how you're so drawn back to this passion of yours. I think prep and spontaneity are actually two sides of the same coin. They do sound sort of definitionally, at odds with each other. I wrote a blog today, which actually just went out on my side. So this is, it's benefiting from recency bias, but I think this is really, really important. It kind of speaks to that. So almost every day I have a time box, which is, it's called meetings prep. So in this, it's normally half an hour. So in that half an hour, I'll go through, I'll look at all the meetings that I've got coming up that day, and I'll do just a little bit of preparation for each of them. So that includes this podcast, with you. And what that means then is that I look forward to each of these interactions because I feel like I'm on the front foot. I've done a little bit of preparation, or I'll probably perform better than I would otherwise. It's a signal of respect to, whoever it is, whether it's a podcast like this, or it's, one-to-one session with someone, in my company. It's a signal of respect. So now that doesn't mean that in those individual interactions, I mean, like right now with you, I didn't rehearse this very sentence that I'm coming up with now. There's plenty of spontaneity and I hope spark that people can hear when they're listening to this, but the preparation still goes a long way. And there's a combination of the two. You want the spontaneity and the spark, but actually you light a fire under that with the preparation that happens early on. It's just a very pragmatic example of, a meetings prep half hour goes such a long way to make you feel better about the day ahead and then do better in it while retaining some spontaneity too.
The other aspect of that sort of akin is we had a program called the Second Science Project at the University of Chicago for 5 years. It was working with behavioral scientists, and we looked at improvisation through the lens of behavioral science and vice versa. Nick Epley, who's one of the scientists we work with, a lot of his research is around that people don't self-disclose, that they're fearful of doing that, that they think it's going to be uncomfortable, when in fact, just a couple of small things, or that's a person we have in common, whether it's a football club, I'm a Tottenham Hotspurs guy, whatever it is, those things are, it's like, they're little, but they actually ground us in ways to connect more quickly and feel more warmly to the other person. So just thinking in terms of a business person, being able to walk into that meeting and know a couple of things about the person you're meeting with, especially in an interview or a sales situation. And it's always surprising to me that people who don't do that, because it reflects, do I want to work with someone who went in blind, or do I work with someone who had just a little bit of, respect to take a few minutes to read the invite and know that last question I'm going to ask, which you did. Mostly the guests I have don't, and they haven't. That's fine. But it does make a little bit of a difference.
Yeah, well, I'm glad it did. And it goes to show that, you know, a little bit of preparation. I think that point of the self-disclosure and of disclosure in general, I mean, this isn't, this particular thing I'm about to say has nothing really to do with time boxing, but it does go such a long way to just connecting with someone else. I was keynoting at an event last week with Harvard Business Review in Brazil. And you know, one of the things I always try and do when I'm at the start of a presentation is say something that's a little bit personal. So, you know, you try and connect. Now, you can't force it, because if something doesn't come naturally, I think, you know, it's probably better to not force it. But if there is an anecdote that is, if it is personal, it's about your life and some struggle maybe that you've had and how you 100%. Overcome it or didn't overcome it, I think that goes such a long way. I mean, it makes me feel connected, you know, to the audience as well. So, yeah, I think that disclosure is a big thing. And you can do that a bit better, you know, to tie it back to time boxing or just preparation of any sort. If you take a look at least at, you know, what city they're in, or what they said last time about, you know, the kids or the work situation that they were in, you know, you hit the ground running. It's more harmonious. It's just a nicer situation, but a nicer way for human beings to interact.
Yeah, so I have a couple stock stories about my family that I tell. I also close a lot of conferences that I speak at. So it's very easy joke for me to go, I know I'm the only thing standing in the way of you in a free bar. So I'm going to try to use my time well. And it's just sort of setting the intention of that moment with a little bit of humor, being graceful a little bit and we're kind of in this together. That's not hard. That's not the hard stuff. I mean, that is, in fact, the easier stuff that I think people make too hard. I'm curious in terms of the technology that you use. When you talk about your digital calendar, can that be anything? Can that be Microsoft? Can that be Google? Or is there proprietary technology that, because you're not selling that in the book, a specific technology?
I mean, I think the technology that you need to live an intentional life and, you know, through this method of time boxing is really minimal. Okay. There's some. So in my case, my to-do list is actually, it's a Google Doc, but okay. You know, it could be a Word doc or any sort of, a doc. And that is online and it's in the cloud, so I can access it from multiple devices and it's backed up. So there's various reasons to, you know, that I like to do it that way. So that's the to-do list. But of course you could have that in a book, and lots of people do keep their to-do list, that way. I'll ask you about your to-do list in a second, Kelly. But then the other thing is the digital calendar itself. So, I actually use Outlook and the Google calendar, mostly the Google calendar, but, you know, both, of course, you know, there are other providers, and really that's not really the thing. I mean, that's, you know, a pretty commoditized service now. They're interoperable. You know, you can have Outlook for work, but Google at home and have the two sync up with each other. I mean, they actually talk to each other quite nicely these days. Wasn't the case, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago, but these days it works pretty smoothly. What I don't use is any of the, time blocking or time boxing apps that there are out there. There is a simple reason for that I'm not saying that they won't work for anyone. I'm just saying that they don't work for me, because the benefit that they bring is to use artificial intelligence to just, you know, find these slots. So if something changes in your schedule, then it will just reorganize things in some kind of optimal way. The problem is for me is that I need to be part of that process. I need to know when things are happening and why, and the under ordering. It depends on things that are very private to me, like, you know, my mood, my energy for doing certain things and not doing others. So, and it actually relates to agency. You know, I lose the agency if another agent, an artificially intelligent agent, is deciding when things are going to happen. So I don't want to disparage any of those, those companies that make those apps. But for me, all I need is, my Google Doc and a digital calendar. And that's plenty to get going with time boxing.
Yeah, so I've got a spiral notebook in which I keep my to-do list. Our company got bought by a private equity firm, so we moved from Google to Microsoft, and we're all still bitter about it. Right. So I have an Outlook calendar.
I hope they're not listening.
Yeah, well, they can listen. They know. I've said it to their faces. And I understand the accounting issue of that, but we work in a collaborative creative industry, and Google's just better that way. And search is not good in Microsoft. That's the other problem. But where I recognized, and the reason I really enjoyed the book, was my to-do list and my calendar are not connected enough. And I'm a big list person. So, you know, there's another wall that you can't see here on Zoom where I have a big idea list of, like, here's big ideas that are sort of looming for me that I might get to, or in free time, I might be like, oh, let me do a little research on that and see if, you know, there's something there for us to do. So, you know, but I need to take more control over my day. And so that in part is this idea of if I can sync up these things between these lists. Oh, and the other thing I loved that you had was the batching of small tasks. Because if you look at that to-do list, I could actually separate it in two, which I should, which is some of, like, these are just like an email you need to send. This is just a follow-up that you need to schedule. And I could put those all in the same 15 minutes or half hour and get it done. And especially, I think you and I are very similar, which is we like to start the day. I like to start the day tackling kind of a big thing. And the reason I will procrastinate on that is it's easier to do the little thing that I should have done. When I wrote my book, I came into the office. I was the first one in the office. I closed my door and I did 3 hours of writing every morning. And that was a big task. That it was my that's my only book, my first book, but it was a big task. And that's how I got it done, because I was floundering for 4 months until I set up that very intentional work. And I was better the rest of the day.
Yeah, because you're building on something, right? You've got some momentum. You feel kind of proud of yourself, right? You've done quite a big chunk of work. It's a lot of people get that from exercise, but I think you can get it from a task as well. I mean, especially, you know, writing a book. There's a few things that I want to respond to there, Kelly. So, first of all, just getting the to-do list into your calendar. So, you know, it's the morning there now. It will be done in 20, 25 minutes or so. You've got these to-do list items. I mean, at the risk of preaching time boxing live on a podcast, what is to stop you picking intentionally the 2-3 items from that to-do list and putting them, placing them into your calendar, i.e. time boxing?
There's nothing. If you know, if I'm looking at the social sciences, you know, I'm not good at judging how much time something's going to take. I'm anchored in some way. I have a fear of commitment to certain things. I know for myself, I like to keep more open time than my colleagues, because my job tends to be, I'm an idea person. That is part of my job, is to simply come up with ideas. It was funny. There was a while there where I was getting so booked on things that I did set aside like noon to one, like, you've got to give me lunch. Like, do not take lunch away from me. So it's just me and committing to another kind of strictness in governing my time.
Yeah. But Kelly, I mean, I really close to guarantee that, you know, come lunchtime, your time, if you put in a couple of these items into your calendar, including maybe batching up some small items, that's very cathartic, actually. If you put together exactly as you say, you know, it's six or seven, or, you know, four or five very small things that you know you have to do. And actually, in some cases, it might take 60 seconds, but it's the most important thing you do that day. That might be a reminder about some kids, something to do with the kids, or something you've really got to do work-wise. So sometimes a small task can be, you know, disproportionately important. But yeah, batching up some small tasks and or doing a couple of the larger tasks. I mean, you know, you're coming off the back of a podcast about time boxing with me. I would dearly like it if that had some kind of immediate effect on the podcast host. And I really, like I say, I really think that you will feel, you know, come lunchtime, well, that'd be something to reflect on, you know, how effective was that? Did I get those 2-3 things done? And maybe to incorporate some more. The answers that you gave, sorry, the reasons that you gave for not doing it, I've obviously heard, you know, many times before. And they are real reasons. They're not good enough, though.
No, not at all. In my defense, I have been talking to everyone in my circle about your book, which is, I mean, that is a thing I do in general. But specifically, part of what I'm doing is I'm interested in this. Maybe you should be interested in this. And if I say that enough, I know I'm going to have to give it a shot in terms of that. So as you're talking, I'm like, no, I should do this. Like, I could set up for, okay, I don't want to do it this week. I'm going to set up for Monday. This is what I'm going to try to do for the week and just see what it's like. I don't doubt that you're absolutely right. I mean, again, you know, as Cal Newport points out, you know, we do not have science around productivity. But what we do have some science around performance. And that's my field. My field is performance. And I understand what's needed to do this work. And it is so... Again, people don't understand this about improvisation, the improvisational format, which is it is so strictly guarded. It is. There are so many sort of rules of engagement and periods of time in which things happen very specifically so that really creative work can be free to get done. So,
yeah,
so that, right? It requires real discipline to create open space.
Yeah. So... Okay, so look, I'm going to check in. I mean, obviously, outside of this podcast, I'm going to check in on you and see how you're doing with it and how lunchtime came. On your point about just, you know, wanting to have some freedom, well, again, time boxing is a way of making sure that you get it because you can time box that. The breaks in. The breaks are really important. Not just because, I mean, partly because if, you know, plans change, then you've got that flexibility, but also so that you're just always, you know, in good form or the best form that you can be. There's a chapter in the book about, and I posted about it recently as well, about breaks. So one of the things that we do with breaks is that we tend to just, we work and we work and we work. Until we just need to take a break, right? Mm-hmm. Just and do. Now, at that point, though, we're not in the best mental state to decide how we're going to spend that time. So we'll default to, you know, eating some chocolate or having a coffee or maybe just, you know, going downstairs to the kitchen, eating something else. If we're a bit more premeditated about it, then we can be more creative because we, you know, we have the wherewithal, you know, earlier on to do that. So is it to, you know, take a walk into the garden, take some deep breaths. Is it to close your eyes for a little while? Maybe you're working from home. You can have a really quick cold shower. Maybe that's the thing that you need to just be a bit more, you know, creative, open-minded about how you take those breaks. So I'm a big fan of breaks as well. I just think that they are also, it's also a time boxable activity.
How, in terms of your company, what's the balance in terms of in-person, remote, hybrid?
We get to go. I mean, we're pretty distributed now. There's 20 of us around the UK and some people in Europe, and actually there's someone in Singapore as well. We are obviously remote first. Most of us that are based in the UK will get together once a month, and that's a pretty good balance now. That, you know, people do still want that face-to-face contact sometimes, and smaller teams get together a little bit more frequently than that, sort of on an ad hoc basis. But that's kind of what we've settled on now. It seems to work for us. It took a little while post COVID to, you know, for I think for most companies and most people to work out what exactly is it that I want now. But that's what we've settled on and seems to be working pretty well.
And do you have an office space in your home that's your place, primary place of work?
Yeah, I do. So, I mean, like I said to you before we went on air, I'm not there right now. But yeah, in general, I have my office space at home, and that's kind of, you know, a bit separate from the pets and everyone else.
And you talk about this too, this idea of paying attention to your senses in terms of your space. And when we went to remote work here, which I was very much not my speed, my son had moved out, so I was using his room. And what I ended up doing was I got like a salt lamp. I got, you know, other things that I could, you know, put in the space to sort of, and I very much sent a signal of getting dressed, putting shoes on, different things that I would do normally to go, even though I wasn't leaving. And it all helped me sort of create a new rhythm in what was an incredibly chaotic time. So the rituals became, I think, even more important. And I think that that is probably true in general for remote workers, is that, you know, that differentiation between home space and workspace, you need something, even though the best term I heard for someone with this was, they said, it's not work-life balance, it's work-life sway, because you're always kind of going in and out.
Mm-hmm.
But it strikes me, time boxing helps that too.
I do think time boxing helps with everything. I mean, obviously you write a book on it and you're kind of obsessed with the idea. But because it's time, and time's kind of always going on, there is a sense in which, it will help at all moments of every day. But on that point in particular, I think so many more people have this burden of choice all the way through the day, right? Because they are working from home. So they don't have, you know, there's no longer a commute. They can be in, you know, they're working from home, but it could be anywhere in the house. They could be at a coffee shop. There's just so much choice, constantly. And that's actually a little bit overbearing. Various rituals, time boxing is one. And obviously that kind of then encapsulates much of the day. But even if you're just, you know, separate from time boxing, some rituals to, at the very least, just reduce the number of decisions and this decision fatigue that we face. So that, you know, we'll look at least at the start of the day and maybe for lunch and maybe at the end, you've got, okay, I'm definitely going to be doing things this way, and I can just sort of follow that path and be in that groove rather than, feeling like you've got to make decisions all the way through the day, which can be tiring.
All right. So I'm going to ask you for a yes and story in the podcast. Before we do that, I will make a commitment to you. I will, at the very least, do a week of time boxing. And this podcast is set to air on April 30th. And so I will either record or read an email exchange or whatever in which I say to you, here's what happened.
Amazing.
And then we can get your response. But I think that I've got to do this because I really do think it's very compelling. And I don't often buy into a lot of strategies that people, for whatever reason. There was a person that we had on, a productivity person who basically offered ways of cleaning out my email box. I did do that, and it was powerful, and it's something that I do not have more than 60 emails in my inbox at any given time. And that's just because I unsubscribed from everything. I realized I love Lumel Nice Pizza. I don't need to have them remind me with that. And that's been actually the iceberg is gone in that inbox.
So that has helped, and that's something that has helped your life even now, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
I think, for me, you say this in the book too. Everyone's different. For me, there was a psychological burden to emails that I couldn't see, that I knew were there, especially as they were in the thousands. And I know people who have 30,000 emails in their inbox, and I'm like, that's bad storage. It's just,
yeah.
It's bad.
Yeah. I'm married to someone like that. Yeah.
So am I.
But that's great that you'll try that, Kelly, because, you know, when someone writes a book, I mean, I guess this isn't probably the case in absolutely every, in all situations, but in my case, certainly, you know, I really believe in it. I mean, I certainly do it. There's, you know, whatever you think about the book, it's authentic. And the number one benefit, I mean, there's, you know, all these benefits, but the number one benefit is that as you're going through the day, you're going to be pulled in these other directions, and that feels stressful. So a lot of us just feel stress unnecessarily every single day. And for me, what time boxing is, okay, I just need to remember to do that. Okay, there is this one thing, just one thing that I'm supposed to be doing at this time. I might not even remember what it is, but I come back to the digital calendar. That's a reassuring process in itself. And I am immediately just less stressed. It feels so, it's so nice to get to that point. And that's the thing that I really want to spread. Sure, you can be more productive and creative and have a log of things. And all those benefits are great too. But it's actually mostly about controlling and living a less stressed out life, you know, really, really, really tangibly. So the fact that you're going to try this, and it's, you know, now it's recorded.
I'm committed now. I have to.
Yeah. Ugh. Now you are. Yeah.
What am I doing to myself? All right. No, it's good. This is a good thing. Do you have a yes and story for us?
Yeah, I do. I mean, first of all, just on this, you know, there's this a lot of rhetoric around saying no, and we should all be better at saying no. And I think that's really important, actually.
Me too.
That, you know, there are some people that say yes, you know, by default, and if they're not, you know, thinking about that, that's going to land them in trouble sometimes. But you know, to quickly come back to time boxing just for a second, time boxing is a system which, you know, helps you decide not to say yes or not to say no, but just like you were saying earlier in this, you know, in this podcast, decide when it makes sense, you know, to signal to yourself and to others when it, you know, it's good to say no or when it's good to say yes. There is no, you know, a default, answer to that question of, you know, should you take on this extra thing? But to actually answer the question, you know, I thought a little bit about this, and here's an example that, you know, has come up, you know, a few times in my life, actually just very recently. Is, you know, I have young kids, they're 8 and 10. And you know, they ask to watch a TV show with you in the evening. Now, for one thing, this isn't going to last very long, right? They're going to be teenagers before I know it. And then so, you know, one, just savor it. But very often you're tired and you just don't fancy that, right? It's the end of your day. But if you say yes, and you don't just say yes, you do the yes and let's also grab this popcorn, let's make a fruit salad, let's just make an amazing experience of it together, their eyes just light up. You've really made someone's day. You've really made someone who you really care about. I mean, arguably the most important, you know, people in the universe to you. And you get your own energy back. So that's the kind of irony with that. Now, you can't do that all the time, obviously, and there is balance. But I'd say that's a very nice and non-work example of a yes and that is, you know, is something I try to do. You know, of course, I don't do it all the time, but you know, when I do it, it feels very good and intentional.
Yeah. You know, this is for my wife and I have both worked at Second City for, I'm 35 years, she's 37, going 38. And we brought yes and into parenting as simply, you find yourself saying no so much, you just sort of like, and then you become this no creature. And it's like, you know, like, what am I doing? Like, yes, and the and is there. So it's not just yes. It's not just like it's yes. And if you do such, such and such, we can go do this. And, you know, so sometimes it's bringing accountability into it, responsibility. But to your point, it's also bringing play and the idea of playing with your kids and sort of unexpected, giving them surprise with you. You surprising yourself, that is so healthy in terms of a relationship because, you know, it's very easy to become your worst didactic self as a parent. So yeah. I love your example.
You start to sort of, you know, fulfill that role of being a parent rather than actually being who you are. That's actually why I love the Peter Pan story so much, that, you know, we really do need as we grow into adults to retain some of our playfulness and youthfulness to, I mean, for selfish reasons, actually, maybe first and foremost to enjoy life and see things the way that we did as kids. But certainly if you've got kids or you're around kids, you can then just tap into their wavelength and make the world, I mean, honestly, really a better place.
The book is called Time Boxing, The Power of Doing One Thing at a Time. Mark South Sanders, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thank you, Kelly.
Hi, Mark.
Kelly, hi. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you. So we are talking on Friday, April 19th. It's 9 a.m. in Chicago. What time is it where you're at?
Right now it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, London.
Okay, excellent. So we recorded our podcast on March 27th, and I said to you I would time box my week on the week of April 1st, which I did do it. Do you want to hear how it went?
I would love to hear that.
All right, here are my observations. And I actually wrote these down this morning, but I have been thinking about it a lot. It was amazing for my productivity on small tasks. So as I have a to-do list, which I always have, and I'm going to show it to you here. I know our listeners can't see it.
I feel like I'm the teacher and you're the kid, but you're doing good.
Yeah. You're Obi-Wan Kenobi. So I have this to-do list, and I would batch 3-4 of these small things, because many of them are follow-up with, check-in on, that sort of thing. And I would put in my calendar, my digital calendar, so we're Microsoft here. I'd say small batch tasks, and then in the notes section, I would literally write down which each of those are. And at first, when I did that, I'm like, well, I'm double double doing it, but that is not the case. By being in the calendar, and when I would go to there, and these were all in half-hour chunks, that I would get done, I'd finish these in 10 minutes. And then I'd be like, I have 20 minutes left over, which was
golden.
It was, and I could either use that time to jump on something else, I could go walk and get a coffee, or whatever it was. It was really, really nice. So the batching, the other aspect about the batching is this morning, as I knew we were going to talk, I went back to that week and I looked at what those batches were, and it gave me an understanding of my own productivity. Where is my attention? Where was my attention? What made something a small task? And was it a small task? There was a philosophy to it that was really interesting. The one thing that was hard for me was when I got thrown curveballs, which is part of my job at Second City, is as a sort of a catch-all. So, and I think I mentioned this to you in exchange, the alum Joe Flaherty passed away, and we knew he was ill. It wasn't a shock, but it was still one of those things where, I've got to get basically a Second City response. I've got to mobilize people to put up media. I had to, we talked to the family, and then that was the rest of my afternoon on one of these. So that meant I had to take the tasks that I had set aside for that time and move them, which was fine. It was not hard to do. I just recognized how much of my job actually ends up being respond in the moment. Kelly, we need you to write up. I need this in like 10 minutes. Can you write up a description of Second City history for someone or whatever it is? So I haven't been able to completely rectify those two worlds yet, but I feel like I'm in the process. So I'm going to stop there.
That's great, Kelly. Well, look, that's really good to hear that you're getting some benefit from it already, and that's after just a few days. Mm-hmm. I mean, batching of small tasks will be the main thing that maybe you get from it early on. Different people get different things, right? It might be that it really sort of makes sure that they do some exercise or they do some meditation or something else. So that's great. And then as for the point about curveballs and life is sometimes like that. It sounds like you had some particularly heavy and unpredictable things that happened in that week. It won't always be like that, obviously. But I think getting to know how urgently you do need to respond to things, that can be factored into time boxing. So, perhaps you do need to leave 4 hours or 6 hours a day where you're just not going to plan it because it's just unplannable. But maybe for someone else, they just don't have that at all. So, it really varies. What I really value is that you tried it, that you spent a few days doing it, you've got some benefit, that we're having this follow-up. Yeah. And I wanted to thank you, actually. I think I mentioned this on email, but the conversation that we had and this seven-day challenge, it's becoming now a thing. So I'm going to be putting together a seven-day challenge. So it's an email that will go to someone that signs up, once per day for 7 days to get them, onto this time boxing habit. So thank you for that.
Well, it's interesting. So this is another thing I talked about. I gave a talk this week for a communications group. And, a lot of what I talk about, almost exclusively what I talk about is sort of the science behind improvisation and the fact that improvisation is a practice. So if you want to get better at listening, you should practice listening. And there are ways to do that. We have exercises. We have nudges. We have all those different things. Time boxing, to me, is a practice in productivity.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because I think we all, and we maybe touched on this a little bit in the original conversation, but we have ideas about how we might be productive. But just like the concept of leadership, it's like, yeah, we all have an idea what that is. Universities, make a lot of money selling these leadership courses, and yet there's very little science that we understand, what makes a good leader and what doesn't. And I think that's true of productivity as well. So at the very least, what you're doing here is like, well, we know what habits are. We have a good idea of some science around that. Maybe this idea of scheduling and looking at what that schedule looks like will make us understand a little bit, because we're probably each a little bit different. But then there are stuff that there's what I think they say usually like 95% of humanity shares characteristics. So I don't know. I think this is there is a even bigger idea behind what you're doing right now that maybe we'll understand better in 20, 30, 50 years.
Or yeah, hopefully a little bit before that. I want to kind of see some of the results of that. Just picking up on your habit point there, Kelly. So there are quite a lot of studies out there that say, you know, it takes 66 days or 21 days or some other sort of range of, you know, time to form a habit.
Yeah.
And a couple of things on that. So one, what does it really mean to say that you've got a habit? Well, it's largely that you do it habitually. I mean, you do it frequently and without thinking. So it's become automatic. The interesting thing to me is that, well, if you've got automation assisting with you developing that habit. So like with time boxing, you can put in a recurring calendar appointment. So you've got some technology which is really helping you to make this habit automatic. My strong contention, and you know, I really want to back this up actually with data, but my strong contention would be that you definitely don't need 66 days to form a habit and for it to become automatic if you're assisted by, you know, robotics and automation. So I think it's actually going to be way less for a lot of people, which is why, you know, 7-day challenge, makes a lot of sense. I'm really grateful actually, you know, for this conversation, the previous one that we had and this one now too, you know, cause it's also nice to follow up and kind of close the loop. One of the reasons I think we did this, and you probably don't do this with all of your guests, is that with time boxing, it's very specific what we're saying that you could do. So you can actually test it. You can test it 7 days later. Yeah. You know,
it's not hard, but you're right. It is very rare to have something so specific that you can try that I will say is fairly dramatic in terms of the short-term results.
Yeah. Well, amen. Hear, hear. I love that you did. And, some listeners will too.
All right, Mark. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me again.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Kelly.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.